This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the last week of July, and this week we put some numbers to how bad the second quarter was in the U.S. economy. It was a record. The economy shrank almost 10% this spring as many businesses were shut down and workers lost their jobs. You may have seen this reported in the news as a 33% drop. That's an annualized rate. It says how much the economy would shrink if it kept shrinking like this for a whole year, and things aren't quite that bad. The economy has likely already returned to growth, though there are signs that growth has turned into stagnation in recent weeks as the pandemic got worse across much of the country. And stagnating after a record quarterly loss of economic activity is not a good place to be. In that context, Congress and the White House are still fighting over how to extend economic aid that kept households afloat through that terrible quarter. Enhanced unemployment benefits have run out this week, and the number of people on unemployment has been rising again, which is a sign that we're no longer getting the job growth that we saw in May and June. To talk about where we go from here, I want to bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist of the Washington Post on the right, and on the left, Dorian Warren, president of the Center for Community Change.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, Josh.
I also want to bring in Shai Akabas. He is the economic policy director at the Centrist Bipartisan Policy Center. Hi, Shai.
Hey, Josh.
So where are we right now? What's the state of negotiations between the parties about what to do about this aid that has run out?
We're not making a whole lot of progress, that's for sure. The Senate's gone home for the weekend. The administration and the Senate Republicans and the Democrats seem at odds on a number of large issues. There's about $2.5 trillion separating the Democratic package from the Republican package, and it's unclear how a lot of those issues are going to be resolved at the moment.
And so what makes up that $2.5 trillion gap? What's the big difference in visions about what some sort of extension of aid should look like?
There's a number of things. One big one is aid to state and local governments. The Democrats have close to $1 trillion of additional support beyond what's already been allocated. And the Republican package right now only allows for a reallocation of the limited amount of money that's already been allocated. So that makes up a large portion of the gap. There's also more funding for schools and I think testing and childcare facilities. And unemployment insurance is obviously the other big difference between the two packages.
Dorian, it feels like we're in this weird situation where it's Democrats who are more ideologically committed to the idea that we need really substantial aid in the economy. But we're starting to see some signs about the political desperation of Republicans to get some sort of extension. The White House has been saying, well, can we extend unemployment benefits for just a week while we figure out what to do next? And Democrats have said, no, we want one big package to sort of to resolve this once and for all. And so it seems like Democrats, while they, you know, families are hurting, they need aid. Democrats also seem to perceive themselves as in a position where if they hold out a little bit, they can get more of what they're looking for.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you have to first understand that for Republicans, they've just been conditioned for many, many decades to believe that they can simply pass off the pain on people and push the blame elsewhere, right? So people of color or immigrants or low-income people themselves and their behaviors, it's the fault of Democrats. And it's worked so often over the past. If you think about rural parts of the country, frankly, that have been devastated by public investment and education cuts, poverty's out of control, COVID has reached, right, red states. So this is affecting not just blue parts of the country, right? And Democrats know that and have been putting proposals on the table, right, as an extension of the CARES Act, which they helped to agenda set around. And really, in a sense, are boxing Republicans in to say, hey, it's not just our constituents, it's your constituents too. And I think that's why you see the disgruntlement within the Republican Party, right? When you have a Mitt Romney or Josh Hawley who are introducing proposals that are similar to where the Democrats are, that tells you something's going on between the White House and congressional Republicans, and especially even within the Senate Republican caucus. There's definitely some pushback by many Republican senators against Majority Leader McConnell around the need to respond. So I do think that there is the chance to get closer here. But also, you know, even if they were to come up with an agreement, say, today or tomorrow, there's still this cliff for people that are going to stop receiving unemployment benefits that we all know will hurt the economy because of the incredible spending by low-income households in particular who don't save and hoard money. They actually spend the money. And that's what's kept this economy from from an even steeper contraction to this point.
Yeah, Megan, as Dorian alludes to there, this isn't just a negotiation between Republicans and Democrats. It's also a negotiation among Republicans. Is there a Republican position on this relief package right now? Because we've seen a number of disputes between the White House and Senate Republicans, including the Washington Post reporting today on Friday that the White House is maybe not so wedded to liability protections for businesses, which has been the cornerstone of what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is demanding as part of this package. Mitt Romney is out with his own somewhat more generous unemployment proposal compared to what other Republicans have proposed, less generous than what Democrats have proposed. So where is the Republican Party right now?
Well, I mean, I think that the Republican Party has very conflicting incentives here. On the one hand, they want the economy to be in good shape as they come into November for re-election because they're already facing the loss of the presidency, and they obviously would least like to hold on to the Senate. But they also have an ideological commitment to smaller government. And I think that this actually kind of gives lie to the idea that this is all, that all of the deficit hawkery was just Republican maneuvering and that they weren't really serious about it. They are really serious about it. They really don't think that the federal government should be spending $3 trillion on these things and subsidizing, you know, state and local government operations to the tune of $1 trillion. You can argue that that's political suicide. And you can argue that they're wrong on the merits, either morally or just sort of pragmatically. But that is actually what they believe in. And it's a sort of interesting moment for the Republican Party to show fidelity to its roots. I think that there are, you know, obvious problems with the kind of differential treatment of taxation and of tax cuts and spending. But that said, that is really what they believe in, and that is causing them a lot of problems. It's a lot less complicated for Democrats who just want to spend as much money as possible and figure out how to pay for it later. You know, I think that both parties are kind of exaggerating how much good the spending is doing or how much harm. You know, I don't think at the moment the problem isn't whether, you know, you can pump all the money you want into households. There's not a lot of stuff to spend it on. The parts of the economy that have contracted are by and large the parts where we don't want anyone in their workplace providing services. So giving people more money to spend on stuff they can't buy doesn't really do anything for the economy. That said, I think that if you continued unemployment benefits for 3 months, it would not throw the economy into, a disaster from which it will never recover. I think ultimately these are sort of such ideological fights rather than pragmatic fights. If the pragmatics were more clear, the ideology would be less important.
Shai, as Megan notes there are parts of the economy that we don't want to reopen right now. Jay Powell, when the Fed made its usual periodic announcement saying that it's going to continue doing what it's doing to support the economy, they added a sentence to the statement this week saying that the economic trajectory is going to depend heavily on the virus trajectory. And that's something that's remarkable to me in the context of these negotiations. As we talk about spending $1 trillion or $3 trillion, whatever it is, that these sums of money are so enormous that the money you could spend on public health measures aiming to reduce the spread of the virus, you could spend an enormous amount of that money and it would presumably still be more cost effective to the extent that it allows parts of the economy ultimately to reopen because you get a handle on the virus. That would be way more cost effective than resigning yourself to mass unemployment and giving people checks so that it's not a problem that they're not working. What is the state of that in this package? Because I know that the White House had resisted even further money for testing for the CDC. It looks like members of Congress have prevailed that that's going to be included in the package. But is there a plan about how to spend that money better than it's been spent in the last 6 months, such that we could maybe look a little more like Europe looks like right now in terms of its virus situation?
You know, I'm not sure that there is. And I think that's been a problem that we've seen since the beginning, where there hasn't been this plan from the federal government of how to attack the issue. It's been mostly delegating to the states, which has not proven to be an effective strategy. For that reason, I really continue to be a pessimist about the short and medium term prospects for the U.S. economy. As Chair Powell said, I don't think it's really possible to get a recovery underway until the virus is at least somewhat more contained, because consumers are just not going to have the confidence to go back and do all the activities and all the spending that they normally would. And that's going to mean continued pain for businesses, continued pain for households who are not employed at the rates that they were before. So these packages really aren't about stimulus, quote unquote. There's nothing to stimulate at the moment. It's really more about treading water. It's about providing what I think is, in many cases, desperately needed relief to households and continuing to prop up the economy while we get the virus under control.
I think the biggest thing that the relief is doing is it's preventing financial obligations from pushing households into insolvency, right? I mean, you know, the main problem that we can actually fix is that people had taken on mortgages, leases on apartments, car payments, and so forth, that if they can't go to work, they can't pay, and that can sort of cascade into a really dire situation for the economy. What the federal government can and should be doing is just providing the money to cover those financial obligations so that kind of more abstract layer of the economy continues to function rather than locking up like it did in 2008. But beyond that, you know, the parts of the real economy that have contracted, you can't fix that as without fixing COVID.
I'm not sure I buy this idea that you can't stimulate the economy right now. I mean, the economy shrank almost 10% in the second quarter. That means we still did 90% of the things that we normally do. You're seeing sort of a lot of shifting in consumer behavior. I mean, I wrote this week about coffee. Starbucks sales are down, but people are buying more coffee to brew at home. There are all sorts of these parts of the economy where there are things that people can do if you give them money. And we saw that there was a significant uptick in consumer spending in April, right after Easter, right around when people started getting those stimulus checks. So I don't know, before we move on from this, Dorian, what do you make of the idea that we've heard from Megan and Shai that basically, you know, that you can't stimulate an economy that's in this position. The money is just to relieve people from insolvency.
I think that's half of it, but the other half is stimulus. Like, this is the Hoover moment, right, for the Republican Party and conservatives. Either we're going to stimulate the economy with spending and particularly targeting money to low-income households, which we know spend it on things like, I don't know, food, shelter, rent, car payments. Just to give you a data point here, during the second quarter, we know that compensation to workers dropped $795 billion. And the Pandemic Unemployment Compensation Program, that's the program that provides the additional $600 per week to unemployed individuals, made up for that loss by $639 billion, right? So we know, and you combine that with the data points around spending by low-income households, not higher or middle-income households, it actually helped keep the economy from an even steeper contraction. So yes, spending by low-income households especially does stimulate the economy. It helps it from going off of a cliff. But I do agree that there can't be any recovery fundamentally until we stem the spread of the virus for all the reasons my colleagues have said, whether it's about confidence, but it's also about people are spending money on basic necessities when you look at the data.
And Josh, I would just add, I mean, I don't disagree with anything Dorian said. I think it really comes down to how you define stimulus. You know, if you're talking about preventing us from going off of a cliff and propping up the economy, I think absolutely that is what's happening with the relief that has been provided and what may be provided additionally. What I meant is I don't think we can get to a place where we're really getting anywhere near back to the economy that we had by just infusing more money into people's consumer and businesses' hands unless we have a better control over the virus.
Yeah, I don't think that saying that spending money on basic obligations like rent and car payments and so forth and food and utility bills is a contradiction of what I said. It is what I said.
Well, I mean, we have seen a pickup in sales in some discretionary categories, too, after those checks went out. I mean, apparel started improving in April at Walmart, for example, after people got those checks. But I want to talk about one thing about what this means for individual households before we go to a break. Shai, there's been this proposal so far rebuffed to push out the unemployment benefits for 1 week as Congress continues to negotiate. The unemployment benefits are not administered by the federal government. They're administered by individual states that have to actually process these checks. So what should households where people are receiving unemployment benefits, what should they expect in terms of timing if and when Congress gets around to doing something? When is that actually going to mean money in their bank account? I mean, could Congress have passed a bill before it left this week saying that unemployment benefits would be extended for 1 week? And would that have meant that the checks that go out this week actually would have included the extension of that enhanced benefit?
The bottom line for most states, I think, is no. The deadline for not having any disruption in those benefits was probably some days ago, if not a week or two ago. What we're seeing over the course of the last several months is that states' unemployment insurance programs are really in disrepair. I think Senator Kennedy from Louisiana had a quip the other day where he said some of them just got microwaves last week. And you know that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but the fact that they can't implement anything more than a flat dollar across the board benefit increase, and that it's taken them months in some cases to get people the benefits that they're owed under this new additional federal supplement is really shameful and just shows how long that we've neglected the system for. So I think the reality is at the moment that even if Congress came back and miraculously reached a deal on Monday and passed something by the middle or end of next week, it would be at least roughly the middle of the month in most states, if not the latter half of the month, before most people were able to get those benefits. Now, it's important to note that they could do it retroactively, so people could perhaps collect the money from the weeks that were missed in between, but that would still leave them obviously with a difference between the amount that they're taking in and they may need to spend over these however many weeks that transpires.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Dorian Warren of the Center for Community Change, Megan McArdle of the Washington Post, and Shia Cabas of the Bipartisan Policy Center to talk about liability. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist of the Washington Post. On the left is Dorian Warren, president of the Center for Community Change. And our special guest is Shia Cabas, economic policy director at the Bipartisan Policy Center. So one of the flashpoints between the parties in Congress as they negotiate this next relief package is whether there should be any sort of relief to businesses from liability to the extent that they might be sued by workers or others who are exposed to coronavirus at those businesses. And so, Megan, I'm wondering what you make of this dispute, because the Republican idea is basically businesses will be afraid to reopen because there's this unquantifiable risk. We need to have confidence. We need people to be able to get back to business. And so we need to shield them from this liability. What Democrats would say is that if people are suing, it's because they have been harmed, and you don't want to encourage businesses to expose people to undue risk. And so that's why you shouldn't give this liability shield. I mean, shouldn't businesses be mindful of whether they're going to give people COVID? Shouldn't that be part of the decision they make about whether to reopen? And isn't exposing them to this liability one of the things that forces them to keep that in mind?
I think obviously businesses should be concerned, but I think that the Democratic view that people are only going to sue if they've been badly harmed is incredibly naive and pretty much what you would expect from a party that is the party of the trial lawyers. In fact, what we know from data on these sorts of lawsuits, personal injury suits and so forth, is that whether people sue doesn't actually correlate all that well to whether they've been harmed. And whether they win does not correlate with whether they've been harmed as much as whether they are sympathetic. And whether they like their you know, for example, medical malpractice, not liking your doctor is a better predictor of whether you'll sue than whether your doctor actually did something wrong. The liability system in general is just not actually that good. This is libertarian heresy, but it's not a very good protection against these sorts of things. This is a place where I think regulation is more clearly needed. You need to establish what are good procedures and then give people a safe harbor if they follow them. You know, employers, especially if you think about smaller employers, like this is fine for big businesses that can hire massive compliance firms and you know, get pay scientists to tell them what the latest research is and so forth. But if you think about like your average retailer, who, you know, has maybe 10 employees, is that person in a really good position to ascertain what the safe way to operate their business is? No, they're not. They're not educated in the science. They're not, you know, going to make good sense of it. They're going to kind of wildly flail, or they may look at it and say, and this is a, you know, regulatory uncertainty is a real drag on the economy. They look at this and they say, you know what? I can't figure out whether it's safe. I certainly can't afford the cost of a lawsuit. And so I'd better not reopen. Now you can handle some of this through their insurers, but this is an unknown liability for insurers too. And insurers tend not to want to write those risks. So I think, or certainly not to want to write them without raising premiums really high. And the problem with that is that, you know, we all actually do have an interest in getting business back up and running. We have an interest in having the economy. I'm not saying that we should reopen, but if we should reopen, if it is safe for all of us to try to start getting back out there, I think that is actually a decision that has to be made at the government level. And then I think once that decision has been made, we have to all act as if, you know what, this is uncertain, we're doing the best we can, but this is what the authorities say, and businesses get to rely on that. I'm going to rely on it too. If we don't take that approach, if we try to make it punitive, what we're going to end up doing is keeping a lot of sectors of the economy shut that we need to be there when hopefully we get a vaccine and, you know, things go back to normal, we don't want to have closed 20 or 30% of the businesses in the country because we couldn't figure out the liability of these.
Dorian, an issue with what Megan lays out there, saying that what you need is a regulatory solution rather than a solution that goes through lawsuits, is that it's not just a matter of businesses not being read up on the science. The science is very uncertain. I mean, scientists are still having an argument about whether and to what extent this disease is spread through aerosols, which is to say things you emit from your face that float in the air and can infect somebody who isn't standing right in front of you. And so, you know, that aerosol question has a lot of very serious implications for what kinds of businesses should be able to operate right now and in what manner, whether you can have a safely operating indoor restaurant, for example. And so if we're going to rely on governments to make that decision, the problem is the governments don't know. And even where they do have some pretty good reasons to think that something is safe or unsafe, they're often making bad choices in part because they're really focused on what's going to affect the local economy and tax revenue. You close restaurants and bars, you lose sales taxes, you lose income taxes. And so I think that some of these governments have really had a thumb on the scale toward allowing reopenings where they had pretty good evidence that they shouldn't have.
Yes, the science is uncertain for sure. But I mean, at the end of the day, this is really about the health and safety and well-being of workers. Workers are getting sick and dying. That's a drag on the economy. If you look at meatpacking, none of us have a problem eating chicken or beef or pork. But workers are dying because employers have not provided equipment. And I'm not even actually paid attention to what little science, you know, consensus we do have, right, on stopping the spread of the virus. We do have regulatory agencies, OSHA for one, right, that has health and safety guidelines that any employer could adhere to. But this doesn't, you know, on liability, I never really hear the right talk about, I don't know, sick days that many, many workers do not have, right? Why would you not offer sick days and say to workers, don't come in sick with COVID, right, if you contract it? This is a question of accountability. And there is big money, by the way, being spent not on making sure that workers can come to work safely. $12.3 million lobbying Congress and the White House between April and June by the Chamber of Commerce just on liability protections. They could have spent that money to equip workers, right, with the proper equipment based on what we know now to make sure they don't transmit the virus to other people. If you have sick and dying workers, you're not going to have a business functioning. And this is going to, as we head into the fall, this is an issue not just for, say, restaurant workers or meatpacking workers. This is an issue for teachers. This is an issue for childcare workers. And it's a question of accountability. We do have some basic health and safety guidelines that's not an, it's a no-brainer, right? It's just a no-brainer to put these in place across the board.
Shai, what is the role that this issue is playing in the negotiations right now? There was this one news report about maybe the White House is not that committed to these liability protections, but Mitch McConnell has been saying for months that this is the thing that he absolutely has to have in a package. He won't even bring something to the floor for a vote if it doesn't have liability protections for businesses. So is that red line is a real red line for Republicans?
It remains a little bit unclear because obviously all of these conversations are happening behind closed doors. But you're right, Senator McConnell has said this is a red line or effectively that. And I would guess that a package has to have something addressing this issue in it. You know, I think Megan and Dorian make reasonable points, and there seems like there needs to be a middle ground here between giving blanket immunity and just having some guidelines that anybody can sue and say an employer, you know, may not have done this, across this T, dotted this I. So I think we're in a place where we need to find what that middle ground is. I'm not by any means a legal expert or know where that stands, but it does seem like it's an important issue in terms of reopening the economy because there are just so many businesses that are going to be nervous about this issue as they see lawsuits continue to unfold. And we don't want that to inhibit the economic recovery.
I want to turn and look a little bit to the future. I mean, this is a topic that's more for a little bit farther in the future, in the sense that, you know, we still need to have a lot of sectors shut down right now. At some point, we don't know when, but, you know, Dr. Fauci seems optimistic that we're going to have an effective vaccine approved in the late fall or the early winter. Sometime after that, it will be widely distributed if it is approved. And then we will hopefully be moving back toward renormalization of society and of the economy. And I'm just wondering what kind of policies we're going to need then. I mean, I know, Shai, you have had a proposal out from Bipartisan Policy Center about a way to rework unemployment benefits that aims to reduce them over time avoid these situations where people are receiving more in unemployment than they were when they were working. That's the sort of thing that's going to be more of a concern when the labor market is renormalizing. What is Congress going to have to do next year, assuming things are getting better, to manage that and to deal with the fact that we've spent all these trillions of dollars along the way?
I think on unemployment insurance, while we absolutely need to acknowledge that it's been essential to propping up the economy, and there's a lot of reasons that people are reluctant to return to work at the moment, namely the pandemic, childcare, other things, that there are reasons to believe that as we move forward and the economic recovery continues, we hope into the fall and into next year, there will be an increasing disincentive there from such a large additional supplemental benefit that workers are receiving. And finding that balance between providing the essential relief to workers, largely through unemployment insurance, but perhaps dividing that in a way so that another round of checks, recovery rebates are sent out to people to make up a little bit of the difference, can reduce the differential there between how much people are getting paid to work and how much they're getting paid to stay home. I think that could be a key to, as we move forward, getting the labor market back to a healthy place. There's lots of other things, though, that are going to be necessary over the medium and longer run. Once we get into more of a typical recession, and I think that's what this is going to turn into because we're seeing a lot of job losses that are not just temporary furloughs, but are increasingly becoming permanent, we're going to need a whole set of policies that really are stimulus, that look more like what was put into place a decade ago when we were headed into the Great Recession. Some of the policies there, whether it's medium-term things like infrastructure, whether it's more immediate things like workforce training and incentives to get people back into the workforce and to get employers hiring, all of those are going to be necessary to repair and get us back on a growth track. And then a little bit beyond that, we have to look at this huge mountain of debt that is piling up. This year, we're expecting to cross 100% of GDP with the debt burden. That means that the debt will be larger than the size of the economy. And it's going to exceed the record high that was achieved after World War II in a couple of years. That's just not a sustainable position, especially on the path that we're on. We're going to have to start making some pretty difficult decisions about what we're spending our money on, especially in the big programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, as well as a significant additional influx of tax revenue to fund the spending that we've all decided as a society we need to do.
Yeah, I want to hear from both Dorian and Megan on this, that as we get through this period where we will have spent trillions of dollars that we hadn't planned on spending because of this event, there will be lost economic activity that will persist for some period as we recover from the economic crisis that has been caused by this virus crisis. Starting with Dorian, does that change what government can do in the long run? Are there things that you wanted to do that are no longer affordable because of that context? Are there taxes that need to be higher than you would have said previously in order to pay that off over time? How does this significant expansion of the debt that we're going to come out with this, how does that affect your policy vision?
Yeah, I think the context is that it will take years of historically fast GDP growth just to return the economy to pre-COVID-19 growth levels. Look, this is, I actually don't think this is an ordinary recession. We're heading toward, we're in depression land here. And so we can learn some lessons from our own history and from other countries around the world. I do think there's three things that will be really important. One is, frankly, recurring cash payments as stimulus to low-income workers, who, by the way, millions of people who have been left out of the unemployment insurance system. Second is to fix the unemployment insurance system. And I want to point to the racial disparities. We now know overwhelmingly, for instance, Black workers are much less likely than white workers to actually receive unemployment, more likely to be denied, less likely to apply for it. And then third, I do think this has to, we need an investment mindset here and an investment in infrastructure. And by infrastructure, I mean that very broadly. Infrastructure in our care economy. If you think about childcare or long-term care, we have an aging society. Those are lots and lots and lots of jobs that can be created that will stimulate the economy, as well as, I don't know, there's this thing called the Green New Deal. We might disagree about the particulars, but there are so many jobs to be created in terms of retrofitting our buildings to make them greener. There's just a lot of investments we can make that will help spur growth. And then, yes, I do think we need to get innovative about tax policy. Not a lot of Republicans were deficit hawks when President Trump signed in the largest tax cut in history, right? That was totally fine. And we we were worried about that, and here we are. So we do need to increase taxes, but there's some other ways we might think about, some other innovative ways to think about new sources of revenue to help pay for this, right? We've been floating a financial transaction tax since the last Great Recession. There are conversations about what does a data tax look like in terms of especially tech companies that are close to $1 trillion in one case, but billions of dollars in mining our data that all of us give up for free. So we can also be creative and innovative about new sources of tax revenue to help pay for all of this.
Megan?
I think the left is in denial about what this means. We've just added an enormous amount of spending in an incredibly short time, and that spending is going to have to be moved from the future. Also, taxes are going up. That's something I've been saying for years. Republicans are in denial about what's going to happen with taxes. They're going up to cover this cost. Now, look, we can spread the cost of this out over a decade or more. We don't need to pay it all off in the next few years, but this is going to accelerate the date at which the Medicare and Social Security Trust funds run out of money, because even though disproportionately old people have been dying, lessening the costs on those programs, also the lack of wages is going to move forward the date at which the trust funds run out of money. More broadly, that means that when they do run out of money, even if it doesn't move forward, we're going to have an extra fiscal overhead. Now, can we afford it? Yes, we can. But can we afford to add $5 trillion or more dollars to our national debt, not to, and have a massive economic setback that is going to lower revenues for years to come? And then can we add on the same level of government spending that Democrats thought we could do a year ago? I didn't think we could do it a year ago, but I definitely am pretty sure we can't do it now. And I think that also goes for Republicans. They have to realize that, you know what, we're actually going to have to come and deal with our old age entitlement crisis. And this is something that has been coming for decades. I've literally been writing about this since I started writing in 2001, that this crisis was coming. Everyone acted as if it wasn't. They have put off the solutions that were relatively easy, small increases in the retirement age, small increases in the amount of taxes people were paying. And now we're at the part where the solutions are really hard. And they just got $5 trillion or more harder. You know, I don't think we know what the ultimate cost of COVID is going to be, but that's my rough estimate of how much we're going to end up in a combination of spending and revenue losses. And we do eventually have to pay that back. We cannot be floated by savers in China for the rest of eternity, in part because those savers in China, first of all, themselves have a COVID problem. And second of all, they're getting old and they're going to want to take their money back out so that they can consume. And that kind of free ride we've been getting for quite some time of the United States just being able to borrow endless sums from global financial markets, as those markets themselves age, is going to get harder and harder to pull off. And so, yes, we are going to have to tighten our belt. This is going to cost us in real consumption. And we cannot paper that over by saying that if we magically spend money, that creates new jobs and economic growth. Countries at the technology production frontier, which the United States is, we are in fact the leader of that frontier, cannot make themselves grow by spending more. Our labor markets were at capacity already. We had already, you know, we're already at full employment or close to it. We are an aging society. We are going to have slower growth in the future. We are not going to have higher growth, and we need to grapple with that.
Shai, I don't believe there's been a broad-based federal tax increase since 1993, when there was a gas tax increase. You have to go back to the 80s to find an income or payroll tax increase that applied broadly to the population, not just to the richest slice of it. Megan talks about the need for some sort of cuts to old age entitlement programs. That is obviously always extremely unpopular. Part of what President Trump realized about how to win a general election as a Republican was to back away from any idea that you were going to cut Social Security or Medicare. Why would that change in the future? I mean, you can say that, you know, we have a crisis that's going to need to be resolved sooner or later, but it seems, you know, for now, we continue to be able to borrow at very low rates. Megan says that's going to run out at some point in the future, although I've been hearing that that's going to run out for quite some time, and it hasn't yet. How do you justify giving, you know, less money to people to live on in old age, reducing the generosity of their Medicare benefits, raising their taxes at a time when it does seem to continue to be perfectly feasible to cover over any of these gaps with deficits?
What I think has become abundantly clear over the past couple decades is that each party cares more about the debt than the other party's priorities, but less about the debt than their own priorities. We've seen that when it comes to Republicans with tax cuts. We've seen that when it comes to Democrats and spending. And I don't think that's likely to change anytime soon. What Megan points to is really important, which is until we get to a place where people realize that there are negative consequences from this, there's no real reason for either party to give up their priorities and focus on fiscal responsibility, debt reduction. We on the outside can do the best job that we can at showing people what this will mean in the future and how things could turn on a dime. Because if interest rates do start going up because investors lose confidence that we're going to ever pay a mountain of debt back, it's going to be very hard for us to dig out of that. We've seen examples of those situations in other countries. Now, obviously, we have our own currency. I think because we have the reserve currency of the world, we're in a better position, but that won't even necessarily last forever in and of itself. We really need to get a handle on these challenges. And I think it's, unfortunately, it may take one of these wake-up moments for both parties to realize that they need to do something about this and be able to convince the American people that that's the right decision.
Shai Akabas is Economic Policy Director at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Shai, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
I've been talking with Megan McArdle of The Washington Post and Dorian Warren of the Center for Community Change. We will be back with Pablo Torre from ESPN to talk about sports. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Dorian Warren, president of the Center for Community Change. Sports are back, providing one aspect of renormalization in society. Professional basketball and soccer are being played in so-called bubbles in Orlando. Players and staff exist within contained communities. They're tested every other day. And so far, coronavirus outbreaks have been avoided in the NBA. The NHL will be taking a similar approach in Canada. Baseball has taken a different approach. Major League Baseball teams are traveling to play in each other's usual stadiums, and this has been a mess. There have been outbreaks on at least two teams, the Miami Marlins and now the St. Louis Cardinals. The Marlins even played a game last Sunday against the Philadelphia Phillies despite knowing of positive tests on the team, and that has led to cascading cancellations. The Yankees didn't play the Phillies, which is probably for the best since at least two Phillies staffers have now tested positive for COVID. No Phillies players are known to have tested positive so far. So maybe baseball should be in a bubble too, but even the bubbles rely on frequent testing with rapid turnarounds, which is not currently available to the general public, and that has some people complaining it is unfair to devote so much in the way of testing resources to the sports leagues. To talk about the return of sports, Pablo Torre joins us now. He's a commentator at ESPN and host of the ESPN Daily Podcast. Hello, Pablo.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's start with the relatively good news. Has the NBA been relatively lucky so far with its restart of the season that ended after there was a COVID cluster on the Utah Jazz back in March? Or is it doing something really well and correctly that could be replicated by other leagues?
Yeah, I mean, there's that old aphorism, luck is the residue of design. And in this case, I think the NBA has a reasonable claim to that kind of dynamic. Obviously, right now, everything is day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month. The bubble is not fully impenetrable. We saw that when one player, Los Angeles Clippers guard Lou Williams, a sixth man of the year candidate, left the bubble, was shown on Instagram at Magic City, a strip club in Atlanta, and then there was a whole controversy around, well, okay, what happens now? Luckily, because the bubble is as constituted, that was a case that could be taken care of. He was put under 10-day quarantine. So there are mechanisms to account for chaos, but I would say that the bubble approach is very clearly the one that has the most sustainability. It's those non-bubbles that has everybody very understandably and very rightfully very worried.
Dorian, is it fair to use so many tests for the sports leagues? I mean, people talk about this as frivolous. My view is that the loss of normal social activities has been driving members of the public crazy in ways that is probably having significant negative social effects. And so it feels to me like it's worth devoting some significant amount of resources if it means that we can have some sports leagues back. But I guess the question is, you know, how many resources are appropriate and fair to devote to that?
Look, I love that professional sports is back. I love the NBA is back. They have figured out the bubble. I was even watching a game last night. So I love it, love it, love it. But to your point, Josh, yes, I think it's a reflection of the deeper inequalities in our country, right? So if you take sports with its billions of dollars, they can create bubbles of safety. They can create fast and accessible testing for their players. They can support their players. They can even pay them for opting out. at the same time, right? Millions of low-wage workers, and especially low-wage workers of color, face those harsh choices between health, keeping food on the table. So if we can figure out how to have a basketball season, a baseball season, a football season, why can't we figure out how to help America's frontline and essential workers? That's the fundamental question to me. As much as I love watching, we all need leisure. I love watching the games. And I think the other professional sports teams in league should actually follow the NBA's lead here. They have figured out something really significant here.
Megan, what do you think?
Look, I think that, first of all, yes, obviously the government should be doing everything it can to promote the availability of widespread testing for everyone, of personal protective equipment. But what we're dealing with is lockups in global supply chains where things that were formerly only used by hospital workers are suddenly in demand for 7 billion people. And the fact is, there's just not enough to go around. There are going to be shortages. Right now, the shortage is of reagents for the tests. We're still having shortages of N95 masks. We should be working as hard as we can in order to make more of those things, but that's going to take time. In the meantime, what do we do about professional sports? And I think that, honestly, I'm with you. I think that people are going crazy. And having something that we can watch that isn't, you know, Portland people throwing fireworks at cops or cops firing rubber bullets at people's eyes is really, really necessary and healthy for the country. And it's such a small number of people, right? You know, if you took all the tests that are being used for all of the major sports leagues and you reallocated them to the meatpacking plants, because it takes a lot more people to make meat for Americans than it does to make a basketball game for Americans, you would not be making a dent in the problem that those workers face. But we can actually give people something to focus on that's positive, that they enjoy, that feels like a little bit of normal. We should absolutely be doing it. And I think that, you know, Major League Baseball either needs to put its people in a bubble or it needs to stop. This is getting ridiculous. You know, I'm a baseball fan. I'm also old enough to just think that, like, partying is not a civil right. So I think that Major League Baseball should bubble its people. And I think that, honestly, when you look at actually, I know that young people feel immortal. But if you look at the increasing evidence that there are potentially for lots of people, you know, a study out of Germany just showed of 100 people, 2/3 of whom had mild cases and never went to the hospital, recovered at home, 74% of them had, or 74 of them rather, had serious cardiovascular, serious heart involvement in their case of COVID. Now it might resolve, but there are people who are like Red Sox pitcher who are having long-term side effects from this. And if you think about that for an athlete, that's just career ending. Then it should be a no-brainer to say, you know what, guys, get in the bubble. It's going to be fine.
So, Pablo, what made Major League Baseball think that this system that they're using could work? I mean, it's wreaking havoc on the whole schedule. It's not just that you had to cancel games for the two teams that had outbreaks. You have these sort of cascading effects. Why did they think they were going to be able to make this work?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so Dr. Fauci came on my podcast this week, and I asked him many of the questions and expressed many of the concerns that you guys just laid out. And what's pretty clear, and he's very savvy and diplomatic and tries not to get in trouble so much these days, although that's kind of impossible. He was very clear that his preference for all of this is to build a bubble, and that all these sports come to him, the commissioners come to him, and they consult him. And what he says and advises is a bubble is the optimal way to do this. So baseball and the NFL, which is unbubbled as well, and college football, which is unbubbled, plus a campus environment, which leads to all of Megan's worst nightmares in terms of that anti-Beastie Boys philosophy of actually you don't have the right to party. That stuff is so unsustainable because in the eyes of the commissioners of those sports and in the heads of those conferences in college, the logistics are too difficult. It's actually too many people. Now, that seems to be an infrastructure question. And to me, I think the reality is that's also a kind of financial question. How much money do you want to devote to building what is the equivalent of, say, a Disney World? Because that's where the NBA literally is right now. When the NBA champion wins the title, they're not going to say, I want to go to Disney World. They're going to say, please get me out of Disney World. Like, that difficulty, guys, is where MLB, I think, tried to cut a couple of logistical corners. But Dr. Fauci also told me, if there is that second outbreak, and with the Marlins, it's over 15 people right now, with the current situation that we're monitoring with the Cardinals. It's currently a couple of players that we're seeing. If that couple of players blooms into an outbreak of the magnitude of the Marlins, it's pretty clear that MLB is going to have to seriously consider suspending the season, which, yeah, would prove all of the doubters of the bubble, of the non-bubble approach, rather, absolutely correct.
Well, and also would seem to make it a false economy. You say, you know, we saved money, we avoided logistical costs associated with the bubble. If you have to end the season, then you lose all the revenue and people get sick. And it seems like that ends up not being a good financial decision in the end.
There's another reason. It's money and also the fact that the players and the teams didn't want it. So the Major League Baseball Players Union is not guiltless here. They had the opportunity to come to an agreement in a labor negotiation with the league, and both sides did not want the bubble. They'd be away from their family. I mean, all the reasons you'd imagine, right? We don't want to be away from our families for this long and our comforts of life, except the alternative is what we're currently witnessing.
But why not just put the families in the bubble? This is what I didn't understand, is why not just bring everyone? Like, you can afford some extra hotel rooms.
Well, so the NBA solution actually is, after a certain point, when the playoffs start about a month into this whole three-month experiment, family members can visit. So they actually have addressed that. I think that is the right solution. And I also think, to be honest, like, look, Dr. Fauci told me how much sports matters. To your point, Megan, right? There's psychological comfort. To Dorian's point, this is stuff we love. This is absolutely something that is not just like any other form of entertainment. And I think that's what any sports fan would argue. But he also says that, look, there have to be sacrifices and trade-offs, that I think if you want sports, the sacrifice on the part of teams and players, it's just greater than what we were thinking when these ideas were first conceived, you know, now weeks and months ago.
I was really struck in that interview you did with Dr. Fauci, how open he seemed to be to the idea that all of these leagues might be able to play this year, even college football, which strikes me as completely insane, the idea that you would have people go from college campuses where they are at least nominally students, travel around the country to play and go back. It seems like a complete nightmare. What did you make of him sort of being sanguine about that? Is it just that he doesn't want headlines where it's like Dr. Fauci is trying to take away your college football? Because, I mean, the people who are associated with the president sort of portray him as this huge wet blanket who's trying to close everything. And yet here he is on your podcast, at least open to the idea that you could do these things that, you know, my instinct would be no, do not have a college football season this year.
Yeah, I think he's very mindful, Josh, of the caricature and the reputation that he has received, which is he is the national scold. He is Mr. Shutdown. He doesn't want you to have the life that you desperately crave and thirst for. And so with sports, which I think he feels a genuine affection for, he does think that there is a road to a return. It just will require, you know, yesterday he went on cable news and talked about a 5-point plan that involves staying out of bars and hand hygiene and wearing masks and distancing and all that stuff. His point is, if we are going to rigorously enforce the best practices of staying safe as regards to the virus, we don't actually need to do a full bubble setup. But I think what is left unsaid there, and I asked him about, you know, why did the NHL set up its bubbles in Canada? Right? And why did they not do it in the US, where all their actual teams are mostly located? Well, it's because Canada is doing a far better job with the virus than the US. And so unsaid in all of this is, it's cool to be optimistic, publicly optimistic. But to verify and validate that optimism, it requires a change in human behavior that our country obviously has not expressed the capability of doing. And that, I think, is where, yeah, his optimism has a pretty clear limit.
Why was his pitch so bad?
So, this was my first question because I'm a real journalist. So, my first question was, how did this happen? And he said that he measured out step by step, literal foot by foot, from a practice mound that he would throw from. And he says that when he arrived at Nationals Park and made the long, lonely walk to the pitcher's mound, which is 60 feet, 6 inches in the major leagues, that he realized that he had actually been practicing about 40 feet. And so you're a 79-year-old man who is now 20 feet, 6 inches short of your actual mound that you're throwing from, and you see Sean Doolittle, your catcher, and he tried to throw it hard to accommodate for that gap, and what you saw was, yeah, it's the first time that I think Anthony Fauci and 50 Cent deserve to be said in the same sentence, but yes, a 50-centian effort.
Well, that's let's hope there's no deeper meaning in that. Pablo Torre, ESPN commentator and host of the ESPN Daily Podcast, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. And there are so many metaphors that I try to avoid. But yeah, they're out there if you want them.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Dorian Warren, what's on your mind?
Well, as we've been discussing, professional sports is back. But it's galling to me that the NFL managed to admit it was wrong on protest, publicly embrace racial justice, and even put $250 million behind those words, all without naming Colin Kaepernick. He deserves an apology from the NFL, period. The man took a courageous stand for racial justice, and that simple act got him de facto blackballed by the white owners of the NFL. There's no other way you can explain it. And I'm pleased to see the NBA, the WNBA, Major League Baseball players following his lead and taking a moral stand, or in some cases, taking a knee or words on the backs of their jerseys for racial justice. But we just recently laid to rest Congressman John Lewis. And in lauding his courage and our reflections about how acts of defiance for justice should be considered patriotic, this profiling cowardice by the NFL appalls me. These players are getting in good, necessary trouble, as Congressman Lewis continues to urge us all to do. And I think the NFL should step up and right the wrong it committed.
Megan McArdle, what's your rant?
Herman Cain died on Thursday. Famously, he did not wear a mask at a Trump rally. And of course, he died of COVID-19. So cue the Twitter warriors who came out to make fun of him for not wearing masks, basically act like he got what he deserved. Normally, as a sound proponent of masks, you might think that I would like to join in the fun and castigate Republicans, and Herman Cain in particular, for not doing what they can to protect themselves and others from the spread of this deadly virus. But in fact, I'd like to talk to the people who have been making a big deal out of Herman Cain's death. This is not the time. Not only because a man's life ended, an entire universe was extinguished when his brain went out. And it is not the right time for you or anyone else to talk triumphantly about the death of a man who, whatever you think of his politics, achieved a great deal in his life, starting from very little. But also because this is not an effective way to advocate for masks. No one wants to see you celebrating the death of another human being, gleefully declaring that they got what they deserved.
For my rant, I agree you shouldn't be mad at Herman Cain. You should be mad at the president, not just for failing to fight the virus effectively, but for creating a culture among his supporters that has shrugged off measures to avoid getting the virus. His supporters should be angriest at all, since they're the ones at the most risk, especially the handful of them who chose to show up to that rally in Tulsa. We've also seen this risk in Congress. Jake Sherman at Politico reporting on Republican staffers who feel pressure to come into the office and to not wear masks when they do. Louis Gohmert, who's a Texas Republican congressman and a mask skeptic, announced this week that he'd been diagnosed with COVID. He announced this in person at the office. He only learned he had COVID because he was supposed to travel to Texas with the president, and he got a routine test on which he tested positive. And so Gohmert, who had been often seen around the Capitol with no mask, put himself at risk, put others at risk, and this is all something that comes down from the top. I realize the president now has been seen wearing a mask in public, but for months he has created this idea that it's just the flu, that masks are for sissies. This has real-world consequences, getting people sick, often people who support the president. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Dorian Warren, Megan McArdle, Shia Cabas, and Pablo Torre. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.